Hey, welcome to the CMO Whisper Show. I'm your host, Steve Olensky. Part marketing practitioner, part ad agency veteran, part journalist. I was a writer for Forbes for 10 years. I've had so many insightful conversations over the years with business leaders, to athletes, to celebrities, to, of course, CMOs. The only difference now is instead of sharing those insights through written form, I'm doing it this way. My guest today has been described by Forbes as an artist, a globe-treading speaker and market seeker, a storyteller who identifies emerging trends and inspires clients to think differently. His name is David Shing, aka Shingy, and he is a true visionary in the digital era who closely observes the unfolding future in the vast online landscape. Following his role as AOL's European Head of Media and Marketing, he then ascended to the role of Digital Prophet at AOL, Oath, and Verizon Media. And in 2019, he embarked on a new journey with his consultancy where he works with the world's top 100 brands, shaping the future of digital engagement. Dude, that's a mouthful, man. Welcome to the show.
I don't know who that guest is, but can I have a chat to that guy about how long his bio is, for goodness sake?
I'm glad there's no word parameters on the bios, but listen, my brother, welcome to the show.
Just take the first sentence, brother. That would have been enough for me. Steve, how are you? So lovely to see you.
It is. We met in Vegas, was it?
Yeah, beginning of the year. Yeah, that seems beginning like a year. Long time ago.
I know, right? It's only 2 months. Good night. We're recording this in the middle of March. It does seem like a lifetime ago.
It does.
One of us is getting old. So I just am fascinated by you, and I saw you later on. I think it was later or earlier. I saw you interview Jay Shetty, right, in New York. Yep. Your career is just beyond fascinating to me. You were one of my idols. And I don't mean to embarrass you, but it's the truth. I'm just such a big fan of what you've accomplished. And I really want to get into all the things as much as we can cover. And I already know there's more than likely going to be a part two. So
I appreciate you, man. And I really love the work you've been doing on the CMO Whisperer. I think it is not just a gorgeous podcast, but the premise of it is amazing because we all definitely want to be able to provide insights to those who need it, because it's what a fascinating time.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's high praise coming from you. So thank you. Listen, I want to dive in. And one of the words that I know I'm personally soapbox on, and I know you are as passionate about, is the word culture, right? And the role, right? I mean, it's such a big word, but it's seven letters, but it carries that kind of thing, right? Culture. And it's almost like I want to start this off, David, with you by going, what's the word association? I say culture, you say?
Creativity. And the reason why I would say that, you know, I love the way you're anchoring around culture. I don't know what your question is, but I'm going to answer my own thought on something that I just want to get off my chest real quick. And the reason why I think culture is at the tip of everybody's tongue is that every single thing that we think about, particularly from a lens of trying to appeal to 8 billion people on planet Earth and 50% of them have never known life without the internet, how do you do it in a way that feels like it's culturally relevant is the follow-up word that goes with it. We can't just talk about word association. We have to talk about word adjacency, because straight out of somebody's mouth, when they talk about culture, they talk about relevancy. But the culture itself feels fragmented. And some of it has got to do with technology. Some of it's got to do with just human culture itself. But it is a very, very, very important word.
It really is. I mean, what do you see when you work with these brands, right, when it comes to culture? I mean, are some more cognizant? I don't even know if that's the word, like of the impact and the significance and importance of culture on everything we do.
Yeah, I think they have a understanding of it. They just don't have a deep belief in it, is what I would paraphrase. And that's not to disregard the power of what people are trying to do in marketing. It's just very hard to understand all the nuances of culture. And by the way, I'm going to try and use as many C words as possible in this podcast, maybe, because beyond collectivity and beyond, you know, social behaviors, for me, the thing that is the end point of all of this, and it gives me pause, is about connection. And the challenge is, if you're a marketer today, if you're a modern marketer today, the way you create connections with people is very, very different than what we've grown up with. And a good example of that is if you look at the global content marketing budget of 2022, it was around $6 billion. Sorry, $16 billion. By 2026, not too far away now, it's estimated to be $487 billion. The entire global marketing budget is about $1 trillion. So half of that's aligned to content marketing. Content marketing, and when we grew up, mate, it was big ads, little content. Now it's big content, little ads. So the concept of culture has been reframed because of the social behavioral changes. Not because of our needs. Our needs are always rooted in our DNA as humans. But the way we connect and the way we think about social behavior is very, very different. That's why culture is it's almost like a capital C, dude.
I could not agree more. And to go a little more granular, do you think there's a difference in age, for example, of a younger a Gen Z, Gen Y, I mean, Alpha, do they have a
difference? No.
Okay.
Now, I'm going to nip that in the bud, which is, I could argue for it, don't get me wrong, and we could talk about demographics as much as we want. One of the things that brands back up their strategies with, as you know, is data. And I would say data should give you an insight, and insight should give you a gut instinct, and a gut instinct should give you experimentation, and hopefully some of that capitalizes upon how you connect with people. Awesome. However, I back up. What happens is that when people think about, well, look, I'm going to create the culture that I need around my brand on platforms I don't own. So everybody's outsourced their brands to social platforms or entertainment platforms, period, full stop. They're not really driving people back to their own and owned and operated so much, depending on where we're talking about, of course, but just I'm generalizing. But what I wanted to get back to is that people will talk about things like persona, because why? You can run data across personas and end up with these types of communities, synthetic or otherwise, which are based on data you can collect. Well, I think that whole thing has to be rebooted. And why I'd say that is that instead of things like persona, I think the new is going to be archetypes. And I think there are new types of archetypes out there that we are sort of aware of. We just haven't defined them. And so when we create definition, we have those definitions around boomers and Gen Z and millennials and Generation Alpha, which is new. You know, you look at that and think, wow, what happens is it's just people growing up in a society that's changing. And so you've got millennials that act like boomers, and you've got Gen Z acting like millennials, and you've got alphas growing up to be like they all start to age out of those categories. But what isn't age appropriate are archetypes. So, you know, your spunk and your energy could equate to a 16-year-old Swedish boy, dude, you know, in the way that you have this heightened energy, but demographically and persona-wise, you're not. So I think we have to architect something that's different, and that's why the culture is shifting faster than us as marketers can get our head around how we do this. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes 1,000% sense, and it's frightening to think that it's happening faster, right, than we can keep up.
Well, part of it is there's, you know, there's all this talk about synthetic audiences or types of data that you can run to be able to do sort of pulls, and, you know, to be able to understand where these audiences are, how to target them and make sure that your marketing and your contacting of that marketing is far more effective. And obviously AI is at the cornerstone of that. But, you know, there's something about it today that allows you to say that's on the spectrum of tonnage, which is be everywhere that everybody wants to be, but are you engaging and are you driving with emotion and doing those things that are actually more important than perhaps targeting 8 billion people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, but it's great. It's a great discussion, and I can't help but pause as well going, who's going to define these archetypes?
Well, I think they're defining themselves. You know, I called myself the digital prophet years ago, mate, but I would say a digital prophet is actually an archetype today. It's not a title that I carry. It's a type of person. And remember back when we were talking about Web3 just a couple of years ago?
Oh, yeah.
If I was on your podcast, say 18 months ago, 2 years ago, that's the only thing we would have talked about. But somehow, you know, that person's gone back into the scaredy cat mode. But the reality is that all comes down to gaming culture. Now, there's 3 billion gamers. There's only 5.5 billion televisions, by the way. So gaming is really, it's the deal. So when we talk about immersive technologies, perhaps the metaverse and Web3, you know, we're really talking about gaming culture. And the reason why I bridge this with these archetypes is that there's a type of person that you are meant to be as a digital nomad, as an archetype, or sorry, as an avatar. And then how do you take those attitudes and put them into your real world? And that's the new bridge that we haven't been able to pass through yet. So I'm saying that these types are not being qualified by saying, oh, I'm Gen Z and that's why I act like this. It's like, no. Your interest, the tribe, the people that you hang out with, and whether that's online or offline, the way you realize that is based on your values. You are actually creating your own types of archetypes. The challenge here, Steve, is it's not an easy bucket. You can't just say, oh, everybody between the age of 0 and 13 today is Generation Alpha and they're going to have these attitudes. No, they're not. Because I know plenty of kids in that genre that don't own phones, that aren't highly connected, that don't want to be social influencers, that just want to sit in nature and actually understand that Earth is the most creative environment in the world. You know, there's way different types of people and we just have more splinters. And because we have more splinters, you have to find the niche. The niche is the new mass. You have to find these niches to create the mass. And the challenge with that is when we look at things like old school advertising, and I call all advertising old school today because everything is advertising, it's really, really hard to measure it. So not only do we have to come up with these new types, we also have to come up with new measurement that match the types of engagement we're doing. And at the end of the day, what we're doing is trying to move product, or we're trying to push services, or we're trying to do something that derives a value. We're just using old measurement terms for it, in my opinion. Sorry, it's such a rabbit warren we're running down, and I didn't know where we're going today, and I don't care where we're going today, but I just find it so, I'm so passionate about the fact that everything has to be reframed.
I agree with you. And as I'm listening to you, and I can't help think about I hate to use the word, but there are marketers who are lazy, mm-hmm. and a lazy kind of reaction or a lazy way of doing, okay, like you just said, everybody who's in Gen C acts this, does this, wears this.
Right.
And then the minute they move into the next one, they do, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, they start acting like their parents. They're like, well, what happened to that generation?
Exactly. Right. So as these archetypes are being built on their own, right, they're being defined on their own, which is the way they should be very organic. My next fear, if you will marketers accept these new archetypes? Because they're coming.
Right. So look, let me give you what I think is an interesting way to think about it. So there is a certain sense of laziness, and some of that came when, by the way, the things like pandemics, of which we've only had one, and there's probably many coming, that gave us a chance to reframe or reposition or at least rethink the way that we were going to act, behave, qualify. Because the things that we want represented as humans are actually reflective of what we expect brands to. So the behaviors that we instill, we want our brands that we adore to also instill those behaviors. But something happened here where we just kind of went the opposite way and we've overflexed into, well, more is more and we need to be everywhere all at once, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the challenge with that is, one, you don't have to be a top 10 marketing spend to be a top 10 brand recognition in the world anymore, period, full stop. You know, and there are many examples I could equate. I'll give you one example. So if you think about Coca-Cola, it's one of the, you know, number one brands, Pepsi, one of the number one brands in the world of bubbly waters, et cetera. And then you're in a conversation with somebody and say, well, what about Liquid Death? Have you ever heard of them? And a ton of people will put their hands up and say, I really love what they do. You know, they represent probably 1% of the category, dude. But the mindshare of that brand is massive. And so what has to happen in a modern marketing genre is that they have to understand it's less about an omni-channel, which I still hear every day, by the way, and I think that's completely outdated. And they have to think about an ecosystem. And that ecosystem is the needs and desires of that singular person and what they're trying to accomplish throughout their day. So Steve wakes up in the morning at 8 o'clock. What he wants to accomplish versus Steve at 8 o'clock at night is very, very different. And if you're a brand that can help or hinder those experiences along the way, you'll become a value in that exchange of that person. And by the way, that doesn't all have to be digital. That could be physical too. In fact, if you do look at some of these younger audiences, you know, some of their values feel very old school, mate. I mean, they prefer peer-to-peer reviews and they prefer word of mouth and they prefer friends over ads. These are all things that sounded like old school, but it's actually just been updated to understand that this is just people trying to connect. And if you're a brand trying to do the same thing and you're able to do that throughout the day and understand it's an ecosystem of needs, not just pushing product to people, you change the value exchange. And that, by the way, that transcends genre, that transcends archetypes, that now just understands that you are helping to take up some mind share of somebody. And if it's valuable and relevant to your brand and your business, then you'll get it, which is not too dissimilar to why marketing was founded. It's just reframed. I don't know how many times I'm going to say that today. So I didn't think reframed was going to be the word of the day. I thought I was going to stay with my C's. but apparently we're into reframing, bud. So it's
I think we're up to five, and I'll give you a total at the end.
But I also, can I just say one other thing, which is if you get very anxious about all of this newness that's going on, and by the way, the change that's happening is a breakneck speed. If you get nervous and uncomfortable and a little bit scared about it, your natural behavior is to recede and then put your money, put your marketing spend, put your attention in the things and the behaviors that you're comfortable with. So you'll see terrestrial advertising will go up. You'll see television takes a swing at it. You'll see CTV still sort of orchestrate. You'll see lots of money going to social and search. And it's like, okay, cool.
It's almost like what was old is now new again.
Big time. In some ways. Oh, no, not some ways. Absolutely. So if you look at some of the hottest trends that are happening in places like the entertainment platform of TikTok or the social platform of Instagram, it's affiliates. It's people making money by passing brands to other people and getting a commission on it. If you and I had this conversation 20 years ago and we're talking about affiliate marketing, that would have been a hot thing across, you know, these blind advertising networks trying to drive to these sites to get people to get, you know, getting paid commission. So affiliate marketing, absolutely what is old is new again. It's just we want to call it something else. But you look at it and go, oh, that's an affiliate. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, yep. What you're trying to do when you talk about DAOs as a way to represent a company that allows people to have flat management, oh, that's called a co-op. So it's not new, mate. It's just being it's just been repositioned. I'm going to stop using the word reframe, but it's just being repositioned, you know?
No, but it's human nature, right? And because we can't use a quote old word or old term because that will make us look outdated.
Right, but the truth is if you look at the behavior of what it is, it's like, yeah, that's what we call that and that's what that is, right. And that's great. But it's updated to the culture today to say, oh, it's absolutely something that's deserving of attention because it drives value. It just happens to be called, you know. But hang on one second. Let me defend old school for a moment. There's this word I've been bantering or trying out, and I'm going to step over it, so forgive me. But I call it
– go for it.
Yep. Nostalgia? Nostalgia. Yeah, that's what I call this bloody thing, which is, you know, in the buzzword king, dude. But, you know, when it comes to nostalgia, there's something very powerful that allows people to feel comforted and feel heard and feel sort of surrounded by. You know, when you and I caught up at CES, one of the things that I was really intrigued by was some of these old brands that we haven't heard of for the longest time were kind of the talk of the show. Like this revival world is happening. One of the things people talked about was a keyboard that you connect to your iPhone called Clix, I think it's called. You know, 10 years ago, that was called a BlackBerry. Or if you look at G-Shock came out with a watch that was pretty dope, you know, and it's like, wow, they just smartened it up. They made something that felt old new again, and Kodak was the talk of the town because something that used to be chemicals and paper is now, you know, these retro-vibed cameras. And you look at the LP industry, it's $2 billion, mate. You look at the analog camera industry, it's $4 billion. Like there's something amazing around things that feel nostalgic, but when they're updated, they feel relevant, you know?
Yeah, and I would add the word safe.
Safe. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting term because there is something that you – so things are happening and you turn on media and you're bombarded with lots of things that make the world feel like it's a tinderbox, whether it's political, spiritual, physical, then safe is good, mate, you know, and safe is something that helps people participate. I mean, I think that's why I'm sure in the middle of the pandemic – ice cream sales were through the roof, you know, because people are just comforted by things that make them feel comforted, safe.
Yeah. I mean, comfort and safe are not far apart. And it's at the end of the day, it's the emotion that these evoke.
Yeah. And look, think about that, right? So when you talk about emotion, one of the things I've been harping on about, which I've seen a reframe happen, and I really think that reframe happened for me when I saw things like alternate facts enter our vernacular. So we've entered a world where, if we are in a world where everybody is an authority, then facts are no longer relevant. It's only about feels. It's only about emotion. And we're entering a phase of you need to target people emotionally. Like, we know that 75% of purchase decisions are made emotionally. And if that, we sell to the heart, we justify to the head. So if that's the case, why do I see so many performance ads out there? That we so we see so many performance ads because it's a very safe way to market and people become incredibly lazy. But if you're trying to create contagion, something that's super valuable to be passed around in the hemisphere of social, then you've got to put some magic to it. And that magic is in the world of surprise. And can you build performance that has surprise? Probably not. But if you put emotion in the front seat, then we're driving a different vehicle, mate. But most people don't understand that yet. That's why they're playing catch up in a lot of these ways, you know?
Yeah, and the elephant in the room that I refer to this as, with the current elephant in the room, is AI.
Right.
Right. And I know creativity is very important to you. It's very important to me. We both have that creative background.
Right.
And I know, if keeping the topic of AI in the context of creativity, what are you seeing? How do you think it's going to affect creativity when it comes to AI?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So let me create some calm in this chaos. And here's why. If I speak to it just from a data point of one, let me make it about me, as I always will. I will say that if it can be automated, Steve, it will be automated, period, full stop. Okay, so let's get over that. But I'll give you my own story. I'm a classically trained graphic designer. So I come from the old school of bromides. I come from the school of, you know, hand-kerning fonts. So if you want to talk about the difference between Bembo and Baskerville and, I don't know, Dodo, for example, we could debate that all day and I could show you the difference between it all in the kerning and the way the serifs are curved. Great. But that was a craft that was old school. Bromides, typesetting, Letraset, Pantone markers, etc. When I graduated design school, people said, you know, Shingy, design's dead, right? I'm like, what? So there's this thing called a computer, and now computers can allow you to design. And by the way, people have inkjet printers on the desk, and there's 256 fonts and 16.7 million colors. Design, my friend, is dead. But when I speak in large audiences and I say, here, please raise your hand if you think design is dead, not one hand goes up. And the reason for that is you need this thing called style or taste or whatever. So in the design industry, it did take a hit for a while, mate. And we're seeing that hit happen with AI because the confusion and the excitement, but also the fear, has entered the room. But yes, it's a totally different industrial revolution. I respect that. But as I equate it to me, what would take me weeks and weeks of concepting, ideating, and scribbling to sell somebody on an idea, and then to develop that and put it in post, et cetera, just to have posters turn up in a Pizza Hut restaurant, can now be done in milliseconds. And I would much rather have those efficiency tools, of which I believe AI is, to help me take care of a lot of those things that should be automated. So the creativity and the human ingenuity can sit side by side with it. How do you feel about that?
I'm nodding my head, but you can't see me because we're not on video. But trust me, I'm nodding like a bobblehead. That, and I'll take it a step further. I think where AI is going to, look, I get it. People are really apprehensive about losing their jobs. I understand that, right? And some people are going to lose their jobs. There's just, like you said, if it can be automated, it will be automated.
Right.
You know, period, end of story, full stop, however you put it, right? But it's not going to, you know, people who give this like death knell of like, oh, it's going to eliminate 90% of, no, it's not. You just used the word, Chingy, a four-letter word that is so important. It is a tool.
Yeah.
It's a tool. And who are the best at using a hammer or a screw? The best people are how to use that tool.
Yeah, let me tell you that back then, the big elephant in the room was called DTP, desktop publishing. And the DTP of this industry today is AI. But I would say that if we reframe that, my friend, we've got this, and part of that fear is, you know, we've got language to language. We all see that with chat, et cetera, et cetera. Really good. But by the way, you know, AI is not new. We know it's been around for forever. If you want some reference to that, you've got Deep Blue. Remember that by IBM? That's a, you know, the bloody machine beat a human at chess. We all knew that was coming, mate. And that was in 96 or something. So, you know, wow, that was before Web 1. So, you know, let's just take a pause on that and accept that this thing is the fastest, slow-moving disruption we've seen. But when you see it rapidly advance from language to language, to say language to action, which you'll see with things like Sora, or you look at things like intentional actions, which is what kind of where I'm thinking about now, I think there's this reframe of artificial to be augmented intelligence. So let me just underline that. Augmented intelligence means that the tools can sit side by side with you. Steve, do I want to go back to walking around town with a fishing tackle box with has scalpels, Pantone squeaky markers, protractors and electrosets and compasses in that crap? Of course not. So if I can sit side by side with it and I can augment that intelligence with my intelligence, we partner, we don't replace. And when I look at statistics that talk about just the ad community, of jobs that will be replaced, fully replaced by AI by 2030 is less than 10%. And those jobs, mate, should have been automated a long time ago. We're just holding on to that human behavior, and you don't need it. So let those people go on and do better things, man.
Again, nodding vociferously that they're – I forget how he titled it, Shingy, but it was like, these are the six most dangerous words in human history. And the six words were, that's how it's always been done.
Ooh.
And it's so applicable to so many things, right? And you just get in that here are those words again, comfort zone. You're safe. You're lazy. This is how we've always done it. Think about society as a whole, not to get all philosophical on everybody, but if we're not open to innovation, we're standing still and we're going to die.
Yeah. But this moment is different. And why this moment is different is that, and by the way, there aren't too many leaders in AI that are absolutely radicalizing it. And those that have been at this for quite some time. But it's, as I said, it's the slowest moving, incredible disruption. I mean, for 10 years, mate, I've been talking about intelligence being the fourth industrial revolution. But when you look at things like a Samsung frame television at $1,500, as you turn it on, brightens because of the brightness in the room. And then it dims itself when you're not playing Hulu and puts on a photograph or something, so it feels like it's wall art. All of that stuff being done by the machine without you interfering on it. That's the beautiful thing about invisible intelligence. But it's not just about a prompt. It's not just about a cursor that's blinking in front of you saying, this machine is going to be taking me. It's about how do you actually use these tools to make it better. I mean, I ran media and marketing, as you know. And in your background, with the work that you've done previously as a writer, or still do, I mean, I think the ability to have somebody help me copy edit right side by side, genius. But what it allows me to do is think about, instead of more copywriters, I need more copy editors. Yep. And then I need people that have style. I need people that have craft. I need people that, you know, so it's not reducing necessarily. It's taking out the thing that we don't need tonnage for. And it's allowing people to create a different nuance and a different refinement, you know? It's never carte blanche.
No, and to reiterate something you said earlier, these are roles and jobs, and not that I'm a fan of anybody losing their job. That's not what I mean. Sure. But these are tools. I mean, these are tasks that should have been eliminated well before this.
Well before this. And part of that also is that as much as we talk about disruption, this is less about disruption. It's about transformation. And that's something we're just trying to get our head around, right? Why is that the case? Because the transformation has clearly happened while people spend more and more time in front of these devices. Now, I would argue, how do we take this stance of less passive attention in these screens and make it more active, intentional? So it's no, you know, I used to talk about the attention economy all the time, dude. And that feels very old school now because I've reframed that alone to be the intention economy. So the time and energy you put into somebody to engage with your brand, they can now have an intention to either lean into it or just decide to swipe away from it. And that's totally different than attention. Attention is just being passive. So how do we activate these archetypes to be far more interactive and far more powerful? Because that's why I think we've moved away from consumers consuming content, which is a stick that I've always talked about. And for 10 years, I've been talking about the curator, the critic, and the curator of experiences, the slash generation. So that's the archetype that I'm talking about, slash DJ, slash editor, slash photographer, slash videographer, slash influencer, whatever they are, slash creator, whatever they want to call themselves. They're a polymath. And as all humans, we are polymaths. In fact, in the US, I think it's something like 40%+ of people identify as being part of the gig community. So what's happening is that these people want to be sort of paid for their side hustle. So how do you take people's interests and turn them into their advocacy, their vocation? And that's the difference, is that, you know, I can think about Steve at work and I can think about Steve as at home, and, you know, it's all the same thing, mate. And so that's the challenge with this transformation. People have their identity is singular. It's not just, oh, a work identity and a play identity. And that's what this societal change is happening.
You just said the magic word, and I'll say it in a second, because you're talking about disruption and transformation, okay? Two very distinctively different words, right?
Right.
But the common denominator of both of those is the word you just said, which is change. And we all know,
right?
Yeah. And we all know, we humans, a great number of us, are very reluctant to change. And I think it's even more pronounced and exacerbated the higher you go up in the food chain of a given brand or a company.
Right.
So you put a C in someone's title. Oh, there's the six most dangerous words, right? It ain't broken, I ain't fixing it. But it is broken, and you don't see that.
Well, that will also mean they're not going to be relevant, and the audiences are going to show that. And the point here is fear is okay. And as a leader, and by the way, if you've got a C in your title and you don't embrace change, then shame on you. And you shouldn't fear it. You should call it out and say, I understand that I fear this, so therefore I need to hire around it or get better at it or educate myself or whatever they need to do to be able to be better at it. And they should hire much better people to help surround them with, because they can be the facilitator of what they do very well, which is probably to orchestrate how this all works within sort of magically working on an EBITDA in an organization and understanding how to maintain this brand as one of the best brands on the planet, whatever their KPIs are, their own personal KPIs as a leader. But that shouldn't stop things that feel disruptive as innovation, as a brand experience, because that's the evolution of brand. And if you sit in the space of don't change it because it isn't broken, then, you know, you'll be foolish, because what'll happen is that you'll be told to do more with less people, you'll be told to do more with less budget, and you'll be told to do something remarkable about it. But you wouldn't have got the tools to create that. And that comes with a change mindset, mate. And so I love the fact that you locked on change, because I have this quote, which I'm not sure whose it is. Maybe it's mine, I'm not sure. But if nothing changes, nothing changes.
No, I can't.
That is pretty basic, isn't it?
Shingy did not stutter there. He meant to say that. But you're right. And it, as what's the word? I don't know. Oversimplistic as that is, that's kind of the point.
That is the point. And so if you look at all these brands that don't understand how to be part of the culture of, you know, the share economy, to have people take a video that you've created and want to share it or talk about it or value it or love it or pinch or pull it or like it, whatever your KPIs are, then you're not understanding that that's part of the culture. And if you can't speak that culture, then get somebody who can, or get out of that place of saying you need to be relevant in it. So I think brands need to do a massive, big, fat audit to make sure they're showing up in the places that matter. They shouldn't shoot once, cut 1,000 times, because that doesn't necessarily work anymore. And they need to understand that where they get these beautiful, deep, languid engagements with somebody's attention that turns into an intention and they become a fanatic of their brand, then how do they build it to make it more contagious and more relevant to that audience, and repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, and then end up amplifying that through media spend when it becomes successful. Architecting that is not that difficult. It's just getting your head around it is actually quite hard for a lot of people, mate.
All this reminds me of, and feel free to use this liberally, what I'm about to share. I came up with this very on the spot made up stat that I use. You ready?
Sure.
I firmly believe 75% of every successful company in the world are completely successful in spite of themselves. I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do. Meaning, you know, you can take that in a number of different ways, but in the context of what we just talked about, well, it's not broken. We're hitting our numbers. So why would I change anything?
Well, let me tell you where I think the biggest opportunity of change to happen, right?
Okay.
So if we grew up in an industry of performance, buy one, get one free, 50% off, sleep on this mattress for 90 days. If it doesn't work, send it back, whatever that is. It's all performance, dude. Part of that is the culture of the internet where we had all these disparate places that people would visit. We wanted to unify that and homogenize it by cutting holes in it and creating this thing called banner advertising. That hasn't evolved. So the culture of digital economy went around it, and that's where we ended up with social, and social ended up with branded content. Branded content ended up with adjacency, you know, brand adjacency, meaning don't act like a brand, but act like a friend and really act like it. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that's performance. So that's why performance is still happening today, but is less and less relevant. The other thing you've got is story. So people are like, well, then let's just go back and focus on our story because, you know, things are awesome when you have a story that says, once upon a time, I did this. Brilliant. Love that. But it's not enough today. The third part of that success, I think, really comes down to feel or sensorialness. So if you and I jump in a car, sensory, man. You jump in a car and we close the doors, immediately you and I are going to identify whether the car we jumped in is luxurious or it's an economy car. We'll know that by the feel of the leathers, the smell, the sound of the engine, the cabin pressure. There's so many elements that happen in the real world that is a beautiful opportunity for people to participate and show up digitally if they choose to. And they should choose wisely to do that.
Again, it's really that simple, man. Like, why? I'm shaking my head going, why do you overthink everything? Not you, but why do so many people overthink it?
Because here's a challenge, because everybody still thinks it's a consumer is going to consume my content. The elephant in the room is not AI to marketers, brother. It is not. The elephant in the room, is particularly for younger generations, is ad blocking.
Mm.
So my job is to stand up in front of audiences all day, every day, and I ask people openly, who has an ad blocker? And they're in the industry, dude. I'll have like 50%+ of the room put their hand up. If I do that in high school kids, it's more like 80-90% of the room. Mm. So forget about efficiency. We're talking about inefficiency. There's an inefficiency in this industry, and we've just decided to negate it by saying, you know, mate, that's why you see these reports of, you know, if you get a double-digit open rate in an inbox campaign or a double-digit anything in social, or forget that in the open web, you might be lucky if you get a 0.0001% click-through rate. Oh, my God. Is that the thing we're celebrating in the industry? Give me a bloody break, mate.
That's a party, man. Come on.
Yeah. So I guess my point is, once you understand that we've moved from attention to intention, and that's the slash gen, you know?
Yeah.
Whoo, that's where the mindset changes. That's where you can just say, okay, all of the things of behaviors that I learned in the past, like the four Ps, all have to go away and I need to understand what it means. Because otherwise, your competitor next to you will go around you and actually figure that out before you.
Oh, that's not an if. That's a when. That's going to happen.
that's what I'm saying. Happen. You don't have to be a big brand based on money spend to have the mind share of audiences anymore. You just have to be highly relevant to them.
It's a great way to end us. It's a really great way to sum this up. Listen, Shingy, I can't thank you enough. I'm so glad we met.
Friend.
I really look forward to more conversations, both on and offline. That's about it. Thank you for coming on.
I appreciate you greatly, my friend.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the CMO Whisperer Show. I hope you shared this episode with your friends. And if you have not already, please subscribe to be kept up to date on all the latest episodes. And if you're so inclined, leave me a review on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you.